This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Take a listen.
We do not tolerate any mistreatment or abuse of a migrant, period.
That's Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on Monday. He was responding to outrage from the general public and from members of Congress about images and videos of U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback, chasing, blocking, intimidating, and cursing at Haitian migrants along the southern border. Here's what White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had to say about the images.
I don't think anyone seeing that footage would think it was acceptable or appropriate. We just saw this footage. It's horrible to watch. It's obviously horrific, the footage.
Horrific? Certainly. But something else as well. Familiar. The images evoke the gut-wrenching collective memory of slave patrols. The evil unleashed by the Fugitive Slave Act, allowing deputized white men to pursue, capture, abuse, and return black, poor, laboring people who'd escaped unspeakable suffering with hopes of finding freedom. It is sickening. And by some accounts, it's utterly routine.
I was not surprised at all.
Last night, we spoke with Jen Budd, a former senior patrol agent with U.S. Customs and Border Protection and a whistleblower against the agency, who now works as an immigrant rights activist. She was on her way to the border, but took time to talk with The Takeaway.
Now, reins and crops used as whips, that's not an actual Border Patrol tool to use. But do Border Patrol agents typically use their reins and their crops to lash out at migrants and to try and get them to do what they want to do? Absolutely.
I wondered why those of us in the public are typically unaware of the abuses happening at our border.
The emphasis on immigration, you know, it started getting bigger in the Clinton years, but it certainly, as far as deterrence policies, but certainly Trump made it popular for, you know, everybody to fall on one side or another. And so more people are paying attention to it. And more people are realizing that, you know, the things that are done in the name of national security, which actually has nothing to do with national security, are human rights violations. And they're brutal and they are cruel. And Donald Trump didn't start this. But he certainly, you know, exacerbated the situation.
Jen emphasized that the language Border Patrol agents use is overtly and purposefully racist.
The United States Border Patrol, mostly through their union, has adopted the wording and the propaganda of the anti-immigrant hate groups, the types of groups that produce people like Stephen Miller. So you see the wording that agents use and how they refer to migrants as subhuman. They call them invaders and criminals. It has a robust, you know, racist culture. They use racist terms. They teach us specific racist terms that aren't used outside of the Border Patrol so that people don't know that we're using racist terms. And they tell us not to tell anybody.
I wanted to understand more about the history and perpetuation of this culture. Jen offered this.
So the Border Patrol is taught that they can racially profile. And they are typically only looking for people who are brown or black. This is the prejudice that has been in the Border Patrol since the 20s. The very first Border Patrol agents were KKK members. The one Border Patrol agent that they refer to as, you know, their first agent ever was actually a guy by the name of Jeff Milton, but they don't tell you on the CBP website his actual name is Jefferson Davis Milton. And he is the son of the governor of Florida, who was, I think he was a general in the Confederacy. And he ended up, when they finally came and told him, you must free your 50 plus slaves, he shot himself because he just thought that was awful. So it's deeply, deeply rooted into Border Patrol culture.
I admit that what Jen said next took me by surprise. She suggested that these horrifying images of migrant abuse might be part of a larger strategy to create even more support for the Border Patrol and its tactics.
It's a game plan by those on the right, with the help of the Border Patrol Union, to exasperate these situations. This is what they want. And frankly, they're happy they were videoed doing it, because it gets everybody upset. At the same time, it gets their supporters upset. That's the visual they want.
And while these images might be part of the game plan for someone, this is definitely not the image of immigration policy that the Biden administration wants to portray.
Unfortunately, the Biden administration is trying to play both sides here. They're trying to seem like they're tough on immigration at the same time, while they're, you know, trying to get people to stop using derogatory terms in regards to refugees and asylum seekers. So they're trying to have it both ways, and it's just not going to work.
Jen Budd pulled no punches in her assessment of the Border Patrol.
They're very smart. The amount of money they spend on their propaganda and trying to show themselves as being humanitarians and saving migrants, although their policies and how they enforce those policies are actually what is putting the migrants into dangerous situations. Everybody goes, well, it's just a few bad apples. And I'm here to tell you that, no, not everybody in the Border Patrol is bad. But a significant amount of the Border Patrol is, and that is the culture. The Border Patrol is the most rogue, corrupt, racist, and inhumane law enforcement agency in the country. Absolutely.
We turn now to Francisca Lucien, Executive Director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Welcome, Francisca.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's wonderful to join you today.
Are you at all surprised by what Jen Budd has said here about the Border Patrol?
Well, I think her words are shocking, and the revelations that she points to are really concerning. And absolutely, the images that came out from the border over these last few days have been nothing short of horrific.
Help me understand why Haitian migrants are at the Texas border instead of Florida.
It reflects the kind of final destination of an arduous journey that many of these migrants have been through over several years. I think one thing that's important to put into context with what we're seeing along the southern border right now is that for many, they left Haiti years ago, especially after the devastating earthquake in 2010. And they have been traveling through numerous countries across South America. And so they're finally arriving at the southern border, and that's what we're seeing now. But this is really the end point of many years of migration for those individuals and families.
And what would those individuals and families have experienced over the course of all those many years of traveling?
Through those travels, they have faced obviously challenges with displacement, difficulties in being able to be received in many of these South American countries. They have faced discrimination along the way. You know, certainly anyone who's undertaking a journey of this scale is facing, you know, immediate humanitarian issues, whether it's hunger, whether it's shelter, whether it's access to health services. And the implementation of policies in 2016, of metering policies in 2016 under the Obama administration, actually limited avenues available to migrants to effectively seek asylum. So they're now arriving at the southern border, really with the hope of finally being able to be processed for asylum. But instead, we're seeing one of the largest and swiftest expulsions that are happening, targeting specifically Haitian migrants.
Can you talk a little bit about that expulsion and what's happening beyond those horrifying images that we saw this week?
Yeah, so these expulsions are happening under what is called Title 42, which is a public health law that is really being misconstrued to justify these mass expulsions. What is happening right now is that the Department of Homeland Security has indicated a plan of as many as 8 deportation flights per day to immediately repatriate Haitian migrants to Haiti, but without offering an opportunity really to pursue an asylum claim.
Okay, wait. I don't want the details of that to get lost. Yeah. So okay. What you're saying to me is that these are families, individuals who have been crossing from Haiti across Central America, up through Mexico to our border for potentially as long as a decade. And we're sending 8 flights a day of people immediately back to Haiti, where the president was just assassinated and where there was a massive earthquake and then a tropical storm?
That is absolutely right. Biden administration officials have indicated a plan of as many as 8 deportation flights. And exactly as you said, Haiti currently is reeling from a 7.2 magnitude earthquake that just struck its southern peninsula, estimated that over 800,000 are affected by that earthquake. The assassination of the president in July of this year, rampant gang violence, widespread insecurity, and a worsening hunger crisis. But those are the conditions that Haitian migrants are being repatriated to under this massive scale up of expulsions along the southern border.
Why are Haitian immigrants in particular being targeted?
Well, there's concern that this is yet another instance in an unfortunately long history of discriminatory policies towards Haitian migrants. And that is evidenced by what happened in the 80s. When the United States previously had not been detaining asylum seekers, but in an effort to deter Haitian migrants fleeing the dictatorship in Haiti at the time, they established an immigrant detention system. I think one of the most emblematic examples of that is the Chrome Detention Facility in Miami, Florida. In the 1990s, they then moved to detain more than 10,000 Haitians at Guantanamo Bay. In 2016, the administration in response to what they were seeing of an influx of Haitian asylum seekers along the southern border, implemented what is called a metering policy, which was essentially a policy that effectively limited the number of people who could enter the United States to seek asylum. And I would just add on this point that system was just determined to be illegal by a federal court in California earlier this month. So I think it's shocking to see what's happening right now in present day along the southern border, but it is another instance in a pattern of policies that have specifically targeted the Haitian migrants and the Haitian community, which is extraordinarily concerning.
Is race part of this?
I think considering all of the facts, it's hard to not conclude that racism plays into this. And it plays into the discriminatory policies that we're seeing towards Haitian migrant communities.
I'm also wondering about the public health aspect or the discourse around public health aspect associated with Title 42 and the ways that, again, this language was also used around an HIV/AIDS crisis in the 80s. When you talk about, when I ask about race, I guess part of what I'm also wondering here is if this is hearkening back to a long tradition of believing that that Black and African descended people are actually kind of a disease that spreads, like that, you know, you have to have different water fountains for Black people, you have to have different bathrooms, and that somehow you also can't even imagine asylum for people whose home nation is in such turmoil right now.
I'm really glad that you brought up that point, because I think that one other aspect of the history and narrative around migration coming out of Haiti was, what was said in the 80s and 90s that, Haitian migrants were bringing in HIV here into the United States. So I think that there needs to be greater care taken when evoking public health as a justification for actions that actually impact and may even violate the human rights and certainly the dignity of immigrants coming to the U.S. seeking refuge and asylum. A couple of things on Title 42. There has been very real concern that Title 42 expulsions do in fact violate the U.S. government's own responsibility, both under domestic refugee law and under international treaties. And the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights even put out a statement raising concerns that these expulsions and the massive scale up along the southern border really brings into question, potential violations by the U.S. of immigrant rights here. Also, you know, there's Title 42 is being used or misused as a public health justification, given the current pandemic conditions, but notably in both international and domestic public health experts have come out calling for an immediate suspension of Title 42 and really expressing concern that there is no justification for the use of Title 42, that there are, well-known public health alternatives to manage concerns of, pandemic and prevention in the case of immigration. And I would just add, as a concern to Title 42 as well, domestic courts have also called on the U.S. government to end or limit its use. And notably, a judge issued a preliminary injunction to prevent the administration from expelling immigrant families under Title 42. That injunction was issued on September 16th with a 14-day stay of the ruling that is scheduled to go into effect September 30th. So to see these expulsions happen in a window right before this injunction is scheduled to be executed is doubly concerning.
Francisca Lucien is executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We reached out to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. They declined to respond. Just to note, in the past, the agency has responded to Bud's characterizations, saying, quote, allegations of abuse and corruption are taken very seriously as the slightest hint erodes public confidence and subverts the Border Patrol's ability to effectively accomplish its mission. Joining us now is Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio and former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Secretary Castro, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's great to be with you, Melissa.
Can you tell me, when did you first see these images, this footage, and what was your response?
I saw the images, I think, probably right after they were put up on social media. I'm here in Texas, in San Antonio, which just is a couple of hours away from the Texas-Mexico border. And my reaction, like, I think the reaction of a lot of people was, I mean, what in the world, what in the hell is going on down there that people are being treated like this? People are being treated like animals. And that has no place in the way that Border Patrol agents should treat people. And so it's an outrage.
I have to say the distress I feel that this is happening after we had seen, previous images, the language that you're using of treating migrants like animals, we saw children in cages. I mean, this was part of the rallying cry of Democrats in the context of the 2020 election was, let's change this. Let's make this different. Does this mean that the border policies and practices of the Biden administration are substantively the same as those of the Trump administration?
Well, look, Biden is not Trump. Trump, I believe, had a dark heart toward immigrants and wanted to inflict cruelty. I don't think that's Joe Biden. And Donald Trump left a mess for the Biden administration on immigration policy, and they've had to start to peel back a lot of that. And there has been some good work on that. At the same time, what the images of those kids in cages and the image that we saw the other day of this horse reins being used essentially to whip a migrant, what they have in common is cruelty. And it doesn't matter whether there's a Republican in office or a Democrat in office. We need to be better than that. And what's been disappointing to me over the last couple of days is that President Biden has not offered moral clarity on that. He has not said very clearly, maybe in just more than half a sentence, I think, this won't be tolerated. We're not going to do this. And then there's a larger point, which I think is even more important, in the grand scheme of things, that we promised as Democrats to use compassion and common sense toward refugees, asylees, migrants. If you look up the definition of what a refugee is or should be to this country, these Haitians fit the bill. You know, as y'all have talked about on the show already, natural disasters, deep poverty, gang violence, a political assassination of the president, they are fleeing desperate circumstances. They're seeking a better life in this country the way that people from all over the world of different generations have. And this year, the United States only is allowed in, you know, over 11,000 refugees into the country. That's the lowest number in decades. And the Biden administration said, you know, that they were going to raise the cap. This year, they're going to raise the cap to 125,000 next year. But even if we get to 125,000, that pales in comparison to the number that we've taken in decades past. So this country is not living up, I don't believe, to its obligation to be a place of refuge, a place of opportunity for people who are seeking a better life from around the world.
Secretary Castro, I want to play for you Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton speaking on Fox Business yesterday and talking about the situation and really blaming it on the Biden administration. Let's take a quick listen.
From the very beginning, this illegal immigration problem, it wasn't an accident. Joe Biden invited them in violation of federal law. He's been doing that from the beginning. He gave Haitians special protection so that they wouldn't be deported and sent the message, just like he's been doing from day one of his administration. The message is very clear. We have federal laws. We're not going to follow them. I'm not going to follow them. Come to Texas. Come to Arizona. Come to our country. We'll let you in. We're not worried about any of the problems associated with it. That is the reality we have to accept.
So, Secretary Castro, given that the political opponents of the president are characterizing this policy, in this way, right, really quite differently, I think, than we've been characterizing it, I'm wondering from a pure political strategy perspective, how does the administration sort of respond to misinformation and provide the moral clarity that you've called so for clearly here?
Well, it begins with making the argument. Right now, I don't even think they're making the argument. And the argument starts with that we've seen these kinds of surges of people at our southern border under Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. We live in a neighborhood. We don't live, you know, on an island in the United States. We live in a neighborhood. And when there's deep poverty, when there's strife, when there's political turmoil, whether it's in Haiti or it's in the Northern Triangle countries, we're going to feel that. And, you know, we need to take a mature adult approach to thinking through, not just in the next few days or weeks or months, but really over the long term, how do we deal with that? Maybe the most promising work that's happening, you know, for the long term is the work that Vice President Harris is doing in those Northern Triangle countries to work with them to make sure that people can find safety and opportunity at home instead of having to come and seek it in the United States. And we should be doing that collaboratively, respectfully, not like we've acted sometimes in the past with Haiti too. But we can't act surprised every time this happens at our southern border and then allow, you know, the folks like Ken Paxton here in Texas or Greg Abbott, the governor, to try and manipulate the passions of people and stir up xenophobia. You have to make the argument. You have to offer moral clarity and an alternative, positive vision of where we can go. And right now, the Biden administration is not doing that.
Julian Castro is the former mayor of San Antonio and former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, with the keen reminder that we, in fact, do live in a neighborhood. Thanks so much, Secretary Castro.
Thank you.
Ethiopia is nearly a year into a conflict in its northern Tigray region between the Ethiopian government's military, forces from neighboring Eritrea, and opposing forces from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. There are reports of human rights abuses and sexual violence against civilians and refugees perpetrated by all parties involved in the conflict. Thousands have been killed and more than 2 million displaced. Since June, Ethiopia's government has imposed a blockade on aid to the Tigray region. In August, the Secretary General of the United Nations issued a warning.
The human price of this war is mounting by the day. A humanitarian catastrophe is unfolding before our eyes. More than 2 million people have been displaced from their homes, and million more are in immediate need of life-saving humanitarian assistance, including food, water, shelter, and health care.
And last week, President Biden threatened sanctions against anyone perpetrating violence or obstructing humanitarian assistance. Samuel Getachew is a freelance reporter based in Ethiopia. Samuel, thank you for coming back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Can you give us a sense of this mounting humanitarian crisis in the region? What do we need to know?
To begin with, there has been all kinds of accusations we're hearing from a distance. Some are saying it's the Ethiopian side. Some are saying it's the TPLF that's preventing needed resources to reach the people that need it the most. So it's an open debate, and we're watching it from a distance, not only because we're not able to travel to those parts of Ethiopia, which really needs the voice and the voices of us, the media, but also humanitarian workers that really need to go and save lives. I'm sure to your listeners and to those that have been watching Ethiopia from a distance for a while, this is a catch-22 going back to the era of 1984, where millions of Ethiopians went through the same kind of famine. So it's really a sad moment. It's not just me that's expressing the sadness. I think we're all sad watching the images that are coming from a distance.
Why is the government preventing both humanitarian aid and the presence of journalists?
Again, in terms of humanitarian workers and humanitarian aid, it's an open debate. There are two sides, they're so passionate presenting their side. The government is saying it's the TPLF that's preventing trucks heading to the Tigray region, and the other side is saying it's the other side. So it's really hard to verify the information. But what we know for certain is the fact that millions of people are being affected by this, not just the famine, but the conflicts that's widespread, not just within the region of Tigray, but in Amhara and in the Afar region. So this is becoming bigger than expected.
Are internally displaced persons able to move out of the region? Have folks at all been making it out to seek refuge in other parts of the country or in neighboring nations?
There are thousands of Ethiopians that have been heading to the Sudan, for instance. And there are also those that have been displaced within Ethiopia, millions of them. So even for anyone who is willing to help, it's becoming so huge. I don't know what kind of amount of support is needed to help this many people, because the number just keeps going up. We started from hundreds. Now we're in the thousands that are heading to the Sudan. The Sudanese government has been saying they need resources to feed them. There are many people that are still trying to go to the Sudan, for instance, but there are also those that have been coming to other sides of Ethiopia. But it's an overwhelming sadness and an overwhelming need that the world is perhaps willing to help, but isn't. And that's the sadness of what's happening at the moment.
Okay. From the first time that we spoke, the two of us at least, sort of back in June about the ceasefire, there was at that time as well, Samuel, this sort of lack of clarity about precisely what the various interests of the players and parties in this situation were. What happened to that ceasefire? And is this crisis actually also part of an actual exchange of hostilities at the moment?
The government has said they have wanted some kind of ceasefire under pressure, they said, from the U.S. government, from Washington, D.C., and from other development partners that have been calling for a ceasefire. But from the perspective of the TPLF, they've been saying this is uncalled for, and they weren't consulted. They did not negotiate a ceasefire that's perhaps in their favor. But the government has insisted from weeks ago when they called a ceasefire, saying that they're doing it for humanitarian purposes to allow farmers to farm. Because again, the Tigray region, it's at best, it's a region that's in need of support, humanitarian support. Much of the population has been supported from other regions, transporting food and all kinds of stuff. And also the role of NGOs, including the UN agencies, is so huge even before this conflict began, and it has gotten worse. And people are really dependent on aid, which is no longer available to them. And that's why we're beginning to see the faces of the young victims we've been watching from a distance again.
In the interdependent fabric of humanity, these kinds of crises cannot remain simply isolated to one region in a nation. Have you seen effects in broader Ethiopia, or again, clearly, you know, the refugee crisis in Sudan, but are there ways that folks living in other parts of Ethiopia are beginning to experience the results, the impact of this crisis?
You know, you just have to look at what's happening in Afar and in Amhara region, which we've seen many people. We've even seen dead faces and people that have been killed and displaced and so on. But the accusation goes back and forth. Who's doing it is an open debate. The Ethiopian side is saying it's the other side. The other side is saying it's the Ethiopian side. And without people like myself and my colleagues actually going there and speaking to the victims, it's become so difficult to verify the information we have on hand. But I'll tell you something. I've traveled to the Amhara region. I've traveled to the Tigray region a few times, and there are victims from all sides. It's not just one side. And even the Amharas have been, there are thousands of victims from the Amhara side, as well as the Tigray side and the Afaris. We've seen many people being impacted by what's happening in the Tigray state. So again, it's a really, really sad situation. For some of us who have been able to go to these parts of town, regions, we just see it as a bad dream because the impact, the victims, the numbers just keep going up. And it's just, even trying to cover it and speaking to the victims has become overwhelming in sadness and shock and so on.
Is there hope?
Well, there's always hope. And, you know, Ethiopia has gone through this kind of stuff before. 1984 famine is an example. And I think Ethiopia will build itself up, hopefully. There will be some kind of reconciliation has to take place, because it's also impacting everyday people. And we hope there will be better days for Ethiopia.
Samuel Getachew is a freelance reporter based in Ethiopia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. You're listening to The Takeaway. On Monday, Pfizer announced that its COVID-19 vaccine had proven safe and highly effective for children ages 5 to 11. For some, this was a moment of pure celebration. I'm raising my hand. But for other parents, even those who enthusiastically got the vaccines for themselves, there are additional concerns about their kids getting the shots. For more on this, we're joined now by Dr. Miriam Laufer, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Center for Vaccine Development and Global Health. Dr. Laufer, it's so great to have you back.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so considering that younger children are at lower risk for the most serious consequences of COVID, why is it important for them to be vaccinated?
You know, that's the question on everyone's mind, and I have two answers to that. One is we are seeing in pediatric hospitals now that there are rising numbers of cases of children being hospitalized with COVID. That's probably because they're the population that is universally unvaccinated, and we are seeing the spread of this more contagious Delta variant. So there is certainly a pretty significant burden of disease and even severe disease in children now. The other important issue is that in order to stop the transmission of the COVID virus, we have to have immunity in the entire population. So even though younger children are probably at lower risk to get sick if they get infected with COVID, they can still get infected and they can still spread their infection to others, including people who have poor immune systems, the elderly, and people who will ultimately get sick. And without controlling the spread of COVID infection in this country, we are not going to be able to get rid of the infection.
Do you have an expectation for how soon the FDA is likely to authorize the Pfizer vaccine for, as I like to call them, little people, ages 5 to 11?
I think it's going to come quickly. You know, certainly there's a lot of pressure to get this vaccine authorized, at least the emergency use authorization that's being discussed right now. That's because, of course, kids have just gone back to school, and so they're all in group settings, although they're wearing masks and taking precautions. The need is really urgent right now as kids are back in school, as we're about to enter into the winter months. So my understanding is the FDA is reviewing this as absolutely quickly as they can while still being thorough. The two issues that the FDA will review are first and foremost the safety of the vaccine to see if there are any concerning side effects. And then the other is to look at the efficacy, how well it works. Now, because children tend to not get as sick as adults with COVID, we are looking not necessarily at how well it did at preventing hospitalizations, which was, of course, what we looked at the most in the adult studies. But we're looking at how high the antibody titers are, that is how well the immune system responded to the vaccine to make sure it reaches a level that we are confident will be protective for children.
Now, is it the same vaccine? So in other words, is it the same sort of medication, for lack of a better word, or is it that is simply dosed differently for younger people? Or is there something actually different about how the kiddo vaccine is operating?
Yeah, it's exactly the same vaccine at a lower dose. So that was one of the reasons we do vaccine trials in children. After we do vaccine trials in adults, we decide on the best dose for adults based on the lowest side effects, the highest immune responses. And then we have to look in kids. And kids are not just small adults. They tend to have a more robust immune response to both infections and vaccines. So we know that because children tend to get fevers more often with a run-of-the-mill illness compared to adults. So when we were doing trials of the COVID vaccine in children, we knew that probably we could do a lower dose in order to elicit a good immune response, and also that we would need a lower dose because children were likely to have more side effects than adults. So that's in fact what happened. We found that at the higher dose, at the dose closer to the adult dose, there were more side effects. And with the lower dose, there were a lot less side effects. They actually tolerated the vaccine very well, and they were able to get an immune response that was going to protect them against COVID.
Now, when you say side effects, are you talking about the thing that many of us experienced, which was like a day of feeling kind of achy and groggy and sleepy?
Exactly. So these usual fever, achiness, feeling tired, sometimes headache, all of those things happen with the COVID vaccine because we're trying to encourage your body to make an immune response. And that's one of the side effects of your body making an immune response. I always joke, that's how you know you got the vaccine, is if you have some side effects afterwards. So we try to, of course, limit that. So you give as low a dose as you can, so people have as few of those side effects as possible, while still having a good immune response. The other concern that had been raised about the COVID vaccine was there any risk of, they had noticed in some of the big observational studies in Israel and other places that maybe there was a risk of myocarditis or inflammation of the heart. As a result of that, the FDA required that Pfizer and also Moderna increase the size of their vaccine trials in children to be able to see if there is, in fact, any increased risk of this heart inflammation. They haven't found any concerns for that yet, but it is the reason why we, even after we roll out vaccine, we continue to be very vigilant about the safety of vaccines and make sure there isn't just a very, very, very rare side effect that we need to know about. What we know definitively is that COVID infection is much worse for your heart than COVID vaccine. And I think that the companies and the FDA are being as careful as they can and as attentive as they can to concerns about safety, in particular this element of safety, to make sure that there's a risk that we are unaware of.
Now we're going to dive a bit deeper into how parents are navigating this moment and how so many of us are trying to manage the everyday risks and balance the various aspects of child rearing. So we've got just some basic questions here for you. Let's go to our first call from Oklahoma.
Hi, I'm Scarlett. My question is just, how do I get a toddler to wear a mask? I live in a very, very red state who is very, very unvaxxed, and I have a 2-year-old. I can't stay home all the time, but I still need to keep him safe. Not sure what to do.
All right. What's your response, Dr. Laufer?
Oh, I feel for that mother. And I think this has been a big challenge, trying to get children, especially the youngest children, to keep masks on. You know, some of the advice that I give to parents and I have used myself include explaining the need to wear a mask and how important it is to protect everybody. That's obviously harder to do with a 2-year-old than it is with a 4 or 5 or 6-year-old. I think making sure that parents and the other adults that the child interacts with are wearing masks all the time certainly helps to normalize mask wearing. Some kids respond well to having a special mask or that they're looking forward to wearing, almost like a special item of clothing. And I'll say that I think we have to view this as not an option. Children, unvaccinated children who leave the house have to wear masks. And I give the example of one of my children who, when he was a toddler, did not like to wear pants and he took them off when he came home. But, you know, when we went to the grocery store, I didn't wonder whether or not I needed to make him put his pants back on. He had to put them back on when we left the house. And so I do understand that challenge of it, but I think we have to persist because it's critical that our especially unvaccinated children are wearing the masks. And those 2-year-olds actually are quite vulnerable.
It's funny. At 7, my daughter is much more willing to put on a mask than pants. So I completely understand that. Next up, we've got 2 callers who were curious about extracurricular activities and the risks involved. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Jen. I'm calling from Ronkonkoma. My question is, if masks are required in school and the rates are getting higher, why have they not reinstated masks for sports activities that are indoors?
Hi, this is Anne Marie from Louisville, Kentucky. And I want to know how to balance socialization with safety for kids who are too young to vaccinate. Things like swim and dance lessons are important for developing balance and life-saving skills, and they can't be put off indefinitely. But we definitely want to protect our little ones at the same time.
Doctor, responses.
Yes, so these are all great questions. I struggle with them myself as a parent of school-age children. So, you know, we obviously live in a world in which we're willing to take risks. You know, we say that when we get in the car, with all the things that we do in our day-to-day life, sending children to school during a pandemic also has some small amount of risk. So then from there, when we start thinking about making additional decisions, I like to think you have to weigh safer, not safer. Outside, safer than inside. Wearing a mask is safer than not wearing a mask. You know, more distant activities are safer than, you know, activities where children are bunching up. You know, so some examples of easy things to take out of the equation that I think are probably high risk transmission are, you know, crowded locker rooms in for kids' sports. And so I think each parent, each family member needs to think for themselves. Each family needs to decide for itself, you know, what's the level of risk you feel comfortable with, and making the decisions always on the side of what's, you know, if I have two choices, what's less risky? If I have options that are just a little bit worse, but still okay, then maybe choosing that instead of choosing the higher risk if there's very little benefit for it. You know, we are at the point where, you know, we're over a year and a half into this pandemic. Children have really suffered a lot from isolation. And I understand there is a desire to resume normal life. And what I suggest that people do is they try and get as close to normal as they can with as many safety measures and risk mitigation measures as they are able to accomplish.
You know, on the same topic, we've got a parent asking about, you know, sort of the famous pods that so many of us begin to try to develop to allow some level of normality and socialization. Let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Kathleen from Brooklyn. And I guess I'm wondering, if kids are in school all day together, is it safe to allow them to play together indoors with friends at home, especially once winter arrives? So I spent a lot of time outdoors in freezing cold weather last year, and I'm wondering if windows were open or a fan on, could they be masked and distanced and still play indoors together in the winter?
So this is another interesting question that I think is going to come up more and more. So last year, especially when for the situations where children were not in school, this was sort of less of an issue. But now we have kids who we know are together most of the year or most of the day. And then is there some reason why once the school bell rings at the end of the day, they shouldn't be together anymore? So again, I put this to you as a series of what are the, everything has some element of risk. In schools, children are supposed to be keeping some distance. I'm sure that the practice of that is highly variable and, you know, only under so much control of the teachers and the administrators. And staying in same groups, in which in particular you are able to follow up if people have illnesses, if people have a positive COVID test in the family, is certainly safer than groups where you don't have that amount of information. Because if something comes up, you'll be able to know and be able to act accordingly. So keeping children in the same groups as they're together in school and using similar risk mitigation measures as in school. So for example, they're wearing masks inside, they're not on top of each other inside, they have space between each other when they're eating, then I think that certainly seems like a reasonable option in this setting.
My 7-year-old is very keenly aware that we live in a pandemic. And the other night, like while she was having her bath, she said, should I make the water hot or cold? You know, do the COVID germs like cold water or hot water? I want to make sure I get rid of them. And it just did a little thing to my heart. So how do we talk to our kids, keep them informed, let them have some control and agency, but not terrify them?
Yes. So I think every child responds to this differently. And what I think about our particular crazy time that we're living in is that on the one hand, there's this very scary infection that is making a lot of people ill. And now, of course, there's children who are getting very ill with COVID. So it's scary. But on the other hand, everybody has something that they can do. So by putting on their mask, by keeping their distance, they're actually empowered to make a difference in the pandemic and keep themselves and their friends safe. So I try to balance the, yes, this is very important. You know, it's no joke. You have to do this. You have to do these things because there are significant risks involved. But on the other hand, what a great message to teach kids. Today, you as a 7-year-old have things that you can do to stop the spread of COVID.
Oh, I love that. Dr. Miriam Laufer is a pediatrics infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine Center for Vaccine Development and Global Health. Dr. Laufer, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alrighty, folks, we're over the hump, and that's all we have for you on this wonderful Wednesday. As always, we appreciate you being here with us. We also just want to send out our love and condolences to the friends and family of Willie Garson, the beloved actor best known for his role in Sex and the City, passed away yesterday at the far too young age of 57.
No, it's not a cold war. It's an out-and-out battle. And it isn't just straight people. Every gay guy I know is running off to Hawaii, putting on a caftan, reciting vows, and feeling superior to me.
Caftan?
Oh, yes, with orchid leis.
Aloha.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Let's talk again tomorrow.